Colleges and universities are places of higher learning, and next month we'll see a new class of freshmen head off to campuses across the country. This is often the first time students are living away from home and parental supervision. The other side of college life is the social one. With thousands of other young people on campus, the opportunities to connect are out there. But how they connect is what we'll be looking at today, specifically the hookup culture. With us is Dr. Wes Crenshaw, local psychologist, sex therapist, and author. Also joining us is Sarah Lieberman, originally from Lawrence. She is a sophomore at Cornell University, and together they're writing Consent-Based Sex Education, Parenting Teens in an Internet Age, which will be out in early 2017. And welcome to you both. It's good to have you here today.
Nice to be here today.
Thank you.
So, Wes, what's so different about how sexuality is being expressed on campus these days from a few years ago?
Well, I'm getting old because I've been at this, I think, 24 or 5 years now, and I've, you know, practiced in Lawrence College community for 16 of those years, and I really have seen a cultural shift in how sexuality is expressed. And it, most notably, even though all of the same situations have been present over that time, it's sort of the degree, and the two things that really play out in that is just a much greater freedom of sexual expression, or you could also argue a carelessness of sexual expression depending on the situation, and really how much drinking culture has become a significant part of that. The two seem to walk hand in hand.
And I don't want to be flip here, but a lot of that was present when I was in college. I mean, drinking especially. I don't think that's slowed down one whit.
No, it's accelerated. For example, where I started out in practice, people might be out a Friday or Saturday. There are kids who are drunk from Thursday to Sunday, and heavy binge drinking that in any other age group, as a psychologist, we would absolutely diagnose as a substance use disorder, and a fairly severe one. And in that age group, this is sort of the cultural norm.
And you're less of a fan of dorm life now than you've been previously. Why is that?
Yeah.
She said, guessing that it leads to the first question we just answered.
Here's my thing, and Sarah and I were just talking about this morning, about what her parents' expectations might have been. In my lifetime, the dorm life has gone from being sort of an environment that was designed to transition kids from late adolescence to young adulthood. So there was the Latin term is in loco parentis, the idea of acting in lieu of the parent. It wasn't quite like that, but it kind of was. So you had a lot more oversight, and maybe you had a dorm mom. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or an RD, residential director. Mm-hmm. And there was this idea that 18-year-olds weren't really quite ready to live on their own. So you put them in these big, giant buildings where they're all sort of kept looked after. Well, that is not remotely the case, unless you're at a very conservative college like Wheaton or something where they do really oversee the kids. And so instead you have these big buildings with a lot of beds in them, and that with not a lot of self-regulation for young people at that age, hijinks ensue.
And for a future topic, that brings up a very good question about how responsible should universities and colleges be for the residents in their buildings.
This is a huge, titanic issue right now, because in the same culture, as you all talked about, it was a good show on Friday, about issues of sexual incursion, sexual assault, universities are in an unenviable position of having to discipline students who many times cannot be criminally charged, which then causes them to struggle with legal action. Because if you sanction somebody for something that you haven't put them through a due process for, then you get sued from the other side. And they are just, desperately trying to protect young people like we all want to, and at the same time live within the confines of what they can control and what they can't. I would not want to be working in that
administrative
capacity,
yeah.
At all.
Sarah, you might see this a little differently. You were a guest columnist for the Double Take column this week, and you wrote, and I'm quoting here, "Hookup culture is synonymous with campus sexuality. Casual sex is an accepted practice that most students participate in. All genders and sexualities are equally enthusiastic. It's not typically dirty or rare or a one-way street." So let me ask you this. Has looking for a Friday night date more or less been replaced by looking for a Friday night sex partner?
Basically, it's not necessarily always the goal. But as far as sexuality, I would say you're more likely to be looking for a sex partner than to go on a romantic date. People can still go out and not necessarily be looking to mingle with anyone that they feel romantically towards. But yeah, I would say it's become pretty much the norm to be hooking up rather than engaging in monogamous relationships.
And why do you think, and I'll ask this of both of you, why do you think hookup culture is the predominant sexual culture among college young adults now? Sarah, I'll go to you first.
Well, most of us that are college age are growing up in homes with divorced parents, honestly, and we're growing up in an age of sexual liberation. You know, we're kind of disenchanted with the idea of monogamous relationships lasting all of our lives, and we're also kind of tired of being told what we can and cannot do sexually. It's like an age of freedom. We're learning about ourselves and we're learning what we can do instead of what we can't do.
Yeah, well put.
And I'm flashing back to the 70s here, but go ahead. I mean, you know, really, how is that different from your generation, my generation?
I think that I'm going to take right off of where Sarah was headed. I think that young women particularly feel a sense of sexual liberation. That is, we are in charge of our bodies, our rules. And boy, am I, you know, in favor of that. Mm-hmm. That's why our book's Consent-Based Sex Education is the idea that everything has to start with not only your consent to the partner, but your consent within yourself. Are you doing what you mean to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for this sort of change we see in disenchantment with monogamous relationships, we're seeing replaced with this expression of, I'm going to do this the way I want to do it. The double-edged sword of that is, and you got to remember, I do an awful lot of talking to kids, so I get it from good sources. That idea of what I mean to do isn't as present as I would like it to be in that age group. People are doing things sexually because it is expected, or because it is a social paradigm, or because they're expressing it as a lot of fun. But they aren't necessarily thinking about, is this really what I mean to do in this moment, until afterwards. That's a conversation parents really want to have, not with 20-year-olds, not with 18-year-olds, but with 9 and 10 and 12-year-olds age appropriately building towards a conversation where what I mean to do sexually just naturally follows that.
And this is all sounding very detached here. I mean, where's the emotions here? Or are there emotions here, Sarah?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, because it's like, and don't get me wrong, are you saying that you don't want emotional connections at all? Is that what this is about for most young people at college, would you say?
I don't think it means that we don't want emotional connections ever, but everything I would say is becoming more delayed. People are getting married later in life, you know.
Much later.
And women are more accepted into almost every type of workplace. You know, we're taught that it's okay for us to have these careers being the most important things in our lives. And so we're not necessarily looking for the person we want to spend our entire life with. We're just trying to learn, you know, prep ourselves for our careers and have, like, fun while we can.
And that comes back to the word you just used, that this is considered fun. And I think there's a fundamental change, too, generationally. Over the years, is that this is now looked upon as fun.
And not a way to snag a mate or to
Or as
build
part of a deeper, right,
yes,
right.
Yes. And you ask a good question here, because I think the jury is a little bit out on where this is going to be. And I think in one sense, young women absolutely, and I will defend them to the end, have the right to think sex is fun and to see it as fun. And that's not just something guys ought to get to think.
Yeah.
But I also, were I in the generation, you can tell me what you think, Sarah, I'm not sure I would want to follow guys' views of sexuality.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that would be the best example necessarily. Just saying.
Yeah, as the model. I mean, what is your thought about that?
I mean, it's about equality. Recreational sex do not belong to men, you know.
So the opposite thought would be, maybe everybody could just have a little less. Just saying.
Or be a little more reflective about it. That's my concern is if young women, I hate to go back to this old book, but one of the first books on this topic was called The Hookup Handbook, and it actually sold a ton of copies. Mm-hmm. And their line in there was, girls are the new guys. Now, that's been, 10 or 12 years now, so I don't necessarily want to fly over that. But I think young women probably shouldn't just decide to be a lot more like guys. I think they have their
own
unique
perspective. Sometimes it would help if guys were a lot more like women, I think.
Well, my question here is, what's so wrong about recreational sex? What's so dirty about it?
I don't think any of us are saying that it's dirty, and we're going to move on, because I think what we want to get into is a little bit about the consensual and the consent portion of that, and I think it's recognizing that, it's new and exciting.
Here's what I would say. There's nothing that I would say is wrong with recreational sex. How it has been practiced historically in a more male-dominated culture has often not turned out well. And I would hope young women, as they are forging a much more liberated and enlightened perspective on that, wouldn't just fly over the same territory. That's what I'm saying, where sometimes consent is ignored when it shouldn't be.
So what I want to get back to a little bit is something you mentioned, and that is there a backlash? Is there a negative implication for people who don't participate in hookup culture, Sarah?
Okay, so Wes and I have been talking about this a lot, and I would argue that there isn't. And I have kind of a silly rule that explains this, and it's like the midnight rule. And it's, if you're not looking to hook up with anyone, you leave the party at midnight. And you had fun, you did a good job, you bonded with your friends, you let off some steam, and then you go home and you sleep in your own bed. Because at least the way it works at Cornell is around midnight, everyone moves from the dance floor to the upstairs rooms in the fraternity. And where there's rooms, there's beds. And that's usually where things, kind of get a little bit steamy.
Yep.
But so I don't think there's any backlash. No one really cares about who you're sleeping with, or whether you're sleeping with anyone,
So there's and not to pry, but do people talk more openly about their sex lives? And in that regard, could there be a sense of, I'm listening and all the girls in my dorm are talking about having sex and I'm not?
Well,
and do they feel, that's
where
I'm thinking.
Is there a negative backlash in the other direction?
Are you left out from conversations
about
sex?
Or people are saying, why aren't you having sex?
I don't really think that happens. And also, I think we talk enough about other things that have nothing to do with sex. That's a part of college girls' lives. It's not everything about our lives. And I would say conversations about sex are extremely important, because when we start talking about sex, we start talking about consent, we start talking about assault, we start talking about abuse. And, if one person doesn't have a lot to contribute to that conversation, I think it's worth it if someone has something they really need to say.
I think that's good. And Wes, you talk about consent and low consent culture, meaning what?
Well, one of the terms that is very much being discussed a lot now is the idea of rape culture. And I totally get what that is about and why young women particularly feel that they are in that kind of a culture. What we talk about in the book is low consent culture, because it's more inclusive of both non-consensual sex and also, questionable consent sex. And in my conversations with young people, there is a enormous amount of questionable consent sex. It is the rare young person who's in that party culture we're talking about who won't, over the course of a college career, have something in the low consent range, whether they.
From my question, legally though, if consent is not clear, you're into rape territory.
Or at least sexual assault
territory.
Absolutely. Legally, but a lot of people are very hesitant to say that they were raped. Whereas people are a lot more I've done extensive interviews for the book Wes and I are writing, Consent Based Sex Ed, and a lot of people are like, no, I wasn't raped.
Absolutely.
But when I rephrase, I say, did you have a low consent sexual encounter? I have not had someone say no to me yet.
That's exactly my experience clinically. And I will have people describe something kind of in passing, like, how's your week been? Oh, Friday night I went out and tell a story. And I say, that does not strike me as consent. And they're like, I don't know. It's that level of gray. I see it as as a sexual assault, and they don't self-identify it as an assault. When,
and I guess I'm going to have to ask you to give me an example, because to me the line tends to be very clear. So where's that gray area? Is it, are they saying that, that you have to give me an example, Hill. They went so far and then they got uncomfortable but didn't stop?
More like the next day they looked back and felt that that was not what they would have done if they were sober.
Mm-hmm. If both parties are drinking, that's right. Usually where gray area gets right. Okay. Super much.
And one of the things I think is very critical, because there are three audiences for the conversation about consent in college sexual situations and high school. And anybody, for that matter. One audience is the young women. We're going to kind of stay with standard genders because there's a lot of more complexity to it. And young women are afraid. And we need to understand that it's just different for young women than it is for guys. And it's taken me a while to fully appreciate this and to understand. I don't walk through Chicago and have people intimidate or catcall me. I'm bigger than they are, and I kind of look like I belong there. And I don't worry about that. And I was talking with a young woman about this the other day, and she said, it's like we live in the bike lane. We're told we're safe in the bike lane, and we're riding our bikes, and we're not safe because people are whizzing by us all the time, and they're moving in to try to hit us and knock us over. We're always there. And I was like, wow, I see the metaphor. So that's where this idea of feeling like one is in a rape culture comes from, and I really respect it. Then there's the parent audience, and it has become very gauche of late to say to Sarah, you need to be cautious in certain situations because your risk is increased. That's now become like not okay.
They equate it to blaming the victim.
Right, and it is in nobody, no matter how much alcohol they've taken, ever deserves to be sexually assaulted. It's never justified. Mm-hmm. But in speaking to my good friend Sarah or my daughter, who's the same age, they're exactly the same age, I'm not going to withhold that point that you have to practice personal safety awareness, because no matter how much we wish the world were not one in which sexual assault occurs, that isn't the one we live in. The third audience, the one that we're having a hard time communicating to, is young men.
Yeah.
And when you start the conversation with, hi, you know, knock, 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 I'm here to talk with you about rape culture, the first thing you get is a tweet from that guy with the hashtag not all men, which is a code word, is a code tweet, code hashtag for, you know, you're just a man-hating feminist, you know, out to get me. And so we have to find a way to communicate as parents and as a society with young men that draws them into the conversation. And one of the things we're hoping we can do is, by talking about low consent culture, we can begin to explain, if you don't have enthusiastic consent, if someone is impaired in any way, you can't get consent from them.
Mm-hmm.
We think that's a conversation that could be had.
So using low consent because rape has become such a buzzword that shuts people down. But, you know, unless there is 100% consent, it is rape. And we're not denying that. Yep. We're just using a different phrasing in order to access a wider audience.
So, and just real quickly, I want to touch upon, just to play the devil's advocate here. When alcohol comes into play, you're talking about reduced judgment on both parties. And if both parties are drinking, you know, is his judgment any better than hers? I mean, he's impaired, she's impaired. I mean, and I'm not saying...
Quite often.
Yeah.
In a very, very heavy in alcohol environment, which is defines... I honestly, Danny, have people that I have worked with over the years who've almost never had sober sex. Now, is that the majority? It is not. But in this age group, it is a fair chunk of folks who've rarely had sober sex. Now, there is a difference, somebody was speaking with me not long ago about this, between knowing you're going to sleep with a partner in the evening, it's someone you know, and you already have consent between the two of you, and then you go drinking together and you have sex. That, to me, for a drinking environment, that's the best idea right there, is everybody knows that's the plan in the end, and people still can say no, obviously. later down the road, but that there was some understanding before you became impaired that you were going to couple. But these are the conversations we've got to have. And when I say we need to have conversations with a young man, I'm not leaving women out. It's just they're better at having those conversations, just like Sarah said. They are. They do talk about all varieties of things more easily. And we've got to reach out and find a way to make that conversation.
So how do you define what is and isn't sexually healthy then and convey that? As you say, there seems to be a problem there, particularly with regard to consent. So what is and isn't sexually healthy?
So the way we define sex positive in our book is that you are doing what you mean to do, that you know what you mean to do, that you're expressing that consistently with your values and your perspective on your sexuality. And that's happens better when you can have a good conversation with someone, not just a peer, but preferably with a parent. I know that's hard for people, but we've been preaching it for years. And being able to have that dialogue, you can define what are your values. If your value, and it is very rare nowadays, if your value is that you don't want to have sexual intercourse, what we call penis-vagina sex in the book, until you're married, okay, express that value by your intentional actions. These are just not conversations we have.
Yep. I would say if I was talking to a freshman girl who was incoming and she told me she wanted to participate in hookup culture, I'd tell her, well, I want you to be sex positive. I want you to know who you are and what you want and what your intentions are and who you're going home with that night, and communicate that very early on in the night so that you end up doing what you meant to do that day.
I'll give you an example. The idea, if you come out of it and you're happy with your choice, that you feel proud of it. When I'm talking with a young person, it's sort of this almost funny automatic discussion. So how did your week go? And young person says, oh, I went out with Josh, because, you know, everybody's named Josh. and we had a great time. You know, we had sex and it was consensual, and I'm really glad I did it. I mean, that's such an automatic conversation now because we've had those discussions, and they know what I would define as a healthy sexual relationship. So they like to reassure me, you know, that this is going to come out okay. And then we talk about whatever anxiety or issue they've been having. That's what we need to be looking more towards, is intentionality.
So are there ever hurt feelings that come out of these encounters? Even if you're being as clear as a bell?
I think if you're being as clear as a bell, maybe not. But there's always going to be hurt feelings every once in a while, which is why I think it's just like communication and intentionality is just extremely important. But like I said, overall, girls and boys equally want casual sex when they're in college. So the chances are that you're going to be okay as long as you make it pretty clear.
There are hurt feelings, and that is going to be part of the territory. And what I say in the pre-conversation is, if you're going to move forward on this, be prepared for, you know, what regrets can you tolerate? If you find that you like this person more than you thought to, this is called catching feelings, then, you know, are you going to be able to manage that? Now, of course, that's a hypothetical question, but it sets up the discussion for a later discussion to say it didn't turn out like you wished, but you went into this with your eyes open, and it just helps build that discussion. And parents, you don't have to have a therapist to do this. I'm trying to make it so that parents can do it.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get to. We've just got a couple of minutes left here. So, Sarah, what would you tell a freshman about campus sexuality that's coming on? And I guess it's not part of the orientation, but it sounds like maybe it wouldn't hurt if it were in some form. But, you know, what would you tell a freshman, male or female? Or do you tell them differently, or do you only speak with women?
Okay, so if I was talking to a freshman girl, I'd kind of say what I just said. Like, you know, have intention, be conscious, you know, communicate what you want and, you know, what your intentions are. And honestly, I hate saying this, but stay with a group. I know it ends up being a lot more easily said than done. You know, things get dark and scary and drunk and, like, people don't know what they're doing. But stay with a group and make sure the soberest person in the group knows what everyone wants to end up doing
that night. Take care of each other.
Yes. Like, make sure the soberest person in your group knows if you want to go home or if you want to go home with someone else. Just, that's the best advice I could give. And if I was talking to a boy, it would just, it would be ask for consent before each step. Just please do so. Just make sure you're not too drunk to ask a girl and get her honest answer if she wants to have sex with you, if she wants to kiss you, if she wants to go home with you. Just please do that. I'm begging.
Yeah. And if it's anything other than yes,
you stop.
I would remind them of their mothers and their sisters and women they have cared for and loved in their lives, and to say to them, if it is not worth having sex to be unkind to someone, be kind.
And real quickly, Sarah, what would you tell parents?
I would tell parents that you can fireproof a house, but you don't stand there pointing a hose at it. So you have to arm your kids with the information they need to be safe and to be cautious and conscious and be, you know, genuinely sexually educated. And then you have to let them go and stop worrying.
There is always that. And real quickly, Wes, what do you think of the long-term implications for this?
Well, I'm a little worried about that. I've been married 35 years. I think I have a few years even on Kratzky, and he's been married a long time. Sarah's parents are married. We all like to be married. I'm happy about that. But I'm worried in the future that coupling is going to change in ways that we can't foresee and might be problematic down the road. That's my big concern.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Wes Crenshaw and Sarah Lieberman for joining us today. Thank you so much for a great conversation, as always.
Good to be
here. Thank you.
Thank you.